This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Hit on possibly solving a problem which has perplexed me for a long time, and that is, where did the Yetzer Hara start from? At what point did the Yetzer Hara start?
So we know that Adam ate from the tree that he shouldn't have. Why did he?
So various reasons why he did, why he didn't, but there was already a bit of a Yetzer Hara in him. There must have been something in him, some inclination towards doing wrong. There must have been. Was he created with it? He was created by the very hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Was there a flaw in the creation? What was there in the creation of man that necessitated coming with it? As perfect as man was created, there had to be with it a little bit of the Yetzer Hara as well. I think that we might, at the end of this evening's shiur, I think that idea, a bit of light might be thrown on it. But the second thing is more important and more disturbing, and something probably which in various different ways I'll be speaking about over the next few weeks. I must say that I was very gratified last night to hear Stanley put his finger on the Motzei Shabbos shiur when he said that we were talking about advertising, and the advertising fundis tell us that it's not the first advert that works, it's not the second advert that works, it's not the third advert, it's the fifth or the sixth, they say, that works. And they say it's important to be that the advertisement should come from different sides, not always in the same newspaper. And it's important that people shouldn't even know where they've seen the advert. It's got to be a subconscious thing that you're hitting them over and over again from different angles and different sides, and all of a sudden they think it's their idea. And Stanley said very, very accurately that the Motzei Shabbos shiur is the same thing. That one speaks about a concept from one angle, and a few weeks later from another angle, and a few months later from another angle, and it's only the fifth or sixth time that the same concept has been talked about from a whole lot of different angles that it starts clicking, that one begins to see what it's all about. And that's boom, that's exactly right. I've always said that the Motzei Shabbos shiur is one long shiur. It's a 10-year shiur. Anybody who's been through 10 years, I think, doesn't have to come anymore after 10 years. But for 10 years, it's a 10-year shiur. And this subject that I'm going to talk about tonight is something which has come up in patches in the past and will come up in the future, in the near future, in various different forms. That is something very, very disturbing which is taking place today in the world in general, certainly, and even in the Torah world. I think you all understand what I mean when I talk about a person who thinks crookedly, a person whose thinking is not straight. It's a very disturbing thing when a person's thinking is not straight, because it's the most difficult thing to prove to him that he's not glad, that he's not straight. It's almost impossible. You simply have to hammer him, because he doesn't see things the way you see things. His deductive reasoning is cockeyed. He'll see a chazal and he'll draw certain conclusions from it, and it's not straight. It doesn't take cognizance of all the factors. It's not deep enough. It's not straight enough. You have a person who sits and says something, and sometimes highly intelligent people and very successful people in their own fields, and they'll talk on not only on learning, but one sees it particularly in learning, and it's partial, it's not glatt, it's not straight. It's something one has to watch in oneself very carefully, that one doesn't it's the fear of any Talmid Chacham is that he should say something which is not straight, that he should say something which is wrong. Is not such a fear. Say something which is wrong, you can fix it afterwards. You made a mistake, can be. That's not the end of the world to make a mistake. But to say something which is crooked is the end of the world, because you'll never get it right. You'll never even know you were wrong. And that's frightening. Rabbeinu Yonah says that when a person does an isur d'rabbanan, he does an isur, a prohibition which is prohibited by the rabbis, not by the Torah, it's more serious than when he does an isur d'oraisa. Why is that? He says several reasons, but one of the reasons he gives is because why is he doing it? Why is he being over an Issa d'Rabbanan? Why is he transgressing a rabbinical prohibition? Because to him it's not as important. If to him it's not as important, he'll never do tshuva. He'll never repent, he'll never correct it. If a person does an Avera and he knows it was serious and he shouldn't have done it, he'll fix it one day. It's not the end of the world. But if a person does an Avera because he thinks it's not so important, he'll never fix it. When a person is not thinking straight, it's a nightmare, because in theory it can never be fixed. There's only one way that it can be fixed, and that is if he puts himself under a Rebbe, and the Rebbe has identified that he's not thinking straight, and the Rebbe has decided to put him right. And they'll come to virtually to blows at every shiur, until after many, many months, he'll start straightening out, he'll start coming straight. Each time he asks something which is not a straight question, the Rebbe will have to make an idiot of him. And every time he gives an answer which is not a straight answer, the Rebbe will have to make even a bigger idiot of him. That's the only way, because you can't. You're going to have to hit him emotionally. He's going to have to feel pain until he realizes this is not the way to reason. And eventually he'll come straight. But it's hard. It's very hard work. That's one area of problem which does exist today, but it's handleable. At least it's definable. But just as there is crooked thinking, and as I said, I think you understand what I mean when I talk of crooked thinking. So there is, in a more disturbing way and in a more difficult way to identify and to appreciate, crooked feeling. A person can feel something which is wrong. And in today's society, feelings are so important, and one acts so much on the basis of feelings, that when a feeling is wrong, a person's olam haba is at stake. A person's whole eternity is at stake, because he's going to act on the basis of those feelings. He judges on the basis of those feelings, and they're crooked. And that's even harder, to persuade a person that his feelings are wrong, and to teach him how to overcome that. That is even harder. I'll give you a couple of examples of that. One example my father was discussing with me only a couple of weeks ago, a very complex one, and I won't give you the whole story, I'll just give you a very small part of it, which is basically a certain man who had a family, a wife and children, belonged to the conservative, to a conservative shul in America, but a very fine, nice person. And his wife died, and he was terribly shattered and broken and lonely, and he couldn't reconstruct his life. After about 6, 8 months, 9 months, he came to a Rav, and he asked the Rav whether it's correct for him to contemplate remarriage. On the one hand, he feels disloyal, on the other hand, he can't tolerate the loneliness. And they discussed it, and the Rav explained to him that he's got to wait until the period of time, until 3 Yom Tovs have gone past, actually a year, and then yes, it would be correct for him to get married again. So he did as he was told, he waited, and after the correct amount of time, he went about looking for a wife. But exactly that, seriously looking for the kind of person that he could set up home with again and try and rebuild his life. And he was fortunate that he found someone fairly soon afterwards. He has children. We'll just talk for this moment about one son who's learning in the yeshiva. One son left the conservative movement and has become frum. And this son doesn't talk to the father. How could you do that to our mother? A year after she's died and you're already remarried. How could you be so disloyal? And if you could do that to our mother, we want to have nothing to do with you. And now the member of the conservative shul, the father, is amazed. He doesn't know what to do. And that's how he came to see my father. He said, "Have I done wrong?" I said, "No, you haven't done wrong. So why is my frum son angry with me? What's the problem?" He's angry. That's the answer. He's angry. But aren't they taught in yeshiva, he said, to overcome anger when your anger is unfounded? Aren't they taught to react on the basis of what is right and what is correct, and not on the basis of what you happen to feel at a particular time? Aren't they taught to adjust their feelings to what is right, and not to adjust their sense of what is right and wrong to their feelings? And this man put his finger on the problem of the lack of musar today in religious society. What does musar mean? Musar means exactly that. Teaching yourself how to adjust your feelings to Torah. Not to stifle feelings, not to cut them out, chas v'sholom, that's not allowed. But to build feelings which correlate with Torah and with halacha. And to learn how to subject one's feelings and channel one's feelings in the direction of Torah. Another example we had was in fact this morning, where there was a young soldier in shul who, after the few words that I said at the Kiddush this morning, came up to me very, very shocked. It's a whole new world. He said, it's so foreign to him and so new to him that it's changed his whole life. And it's like things he didn't realize. What is it? He thought that the young Jewish boys who are sitting in jail for having caused problems in various stages over the last few years are heroes. They are moral people who got up and said and did what they felt was right, pointed out what they felt was wrong, and they're heroes. He suddenly realizes that it's all very well pointing a finger at somebody else is immoral, but there's an immoral way of doing that too. One can do it in a way which is destructive, and that is immoral. So who am I to point a finger at the government for being immoral when I'm doing it in an immoral way, in a destructive way, in a subversive way, in a way that denigrates them, in a way that shows a lack of appreciation for what I'm getting from them? The first time he realized it's all very well to be moral and highly principled, and it's all very well to express one's moral indignation where it is correct, but there's a way of doing it which is moral, and there's a way of doing it which is immoral. And he looked at me with a sort of a pained expression on his face, and he says, why doesn't somebody tell these people? I didn't know it until this morning. Why doesn't somebody go into the university campus and teach these people this thing? The answer, of course, is that these people don't want to hear this. The answer is they have feelings, and they want to express their feelings. To adjust their feelings to Torah, that one already has to be on a certain level for, on a certain religious level. To understand the Torah is not just the practice of various actions, and it's not just the study of various concepts, but it's the reconstruction of one's feelings to coordinate them so that they should coincide with what one is studying, with what one is learning is correct and is right. Doesn't help getting angry about that something which the Torah tells you you're not allowed to be angry about, and certainly reacting in an angry way and thinking I'm a frum yid. And not just I'm a frum yid, do you think that this yeshiva bocher in America that I was telling you about doesn't think he's a tzaddik? And do you think his friends don't think that he's a tzaddik? Loyalty to his mother. Look what he's doing for loyalty to his mother. He's sacrificed a relationship with his family because he feels so strongly about his loyalty to his mother. It's awesome. It's an isur d'oraisa what he's doing. It's a prohibition of the Torah, kibud avayim. He isn't able to understand what the Torah wants from a mensch. And this is occurring in a disturbingly increasing areas and quantities of people. That frum people are not understanding, particularly people who are becoming frum, what becoming frum means. Becoming frum means readjusting and realigning one's whole process of feeling and thought, of course. But realigning one's process of thought is relatively easy. All you have to do is you sit and learn Gemara. And Gemara will teach you how to think like a Jew. But Gemara will not teach you, in the quantities of Gemara we learn, and the way we learn Gemara, Gemara is not going to teach you how to feel like a Jew. How to feel like a Jew only Musar can teach you. And that's hard. That's very, very hard. There used to be Balei Musar. There used to be Balei Musar, the masters of Musar. And every yeshiva used to have one. Balei Musar, we've got some of them here. My great uncle Rebellia was a Baal Musar. A few of the other people around that we've got hanging up on the wall, the Chofetz Chaim, these were Balei Musar whose task in life was to teach just that. Rebellia used to be at Kfar Hasidim, not as the Rosh Yeshiva. In London he was Rosh Yeshiva, in Kelim he was Rosh Yeshiva, in Kfar Hasidim he was brought in not to be the Rosh Yeshiva, not to give shiurim, just to teach the boys how to feel like B'nai Torahs. How to think like B'nai Torahs was the Rosh Yeshiva, he's in that corner. That was his job. How to feel like B'nai Torah was Rebellia's job. And they worked like a remarkable team. It was unbelievable what they produced. And the results of their product is still in Kfar Hasidim today after they've both died. Rebellia many, many years ago. People still remark how you go into Kfar Hasidim and there are still leftovers of the Musa which Rebellia taught there. Still leftovers over there. You'll go into Kfar Hasidim, I believe, still today. And you'll go there early in the morning and you'll hang your coat on a hook. When you come back, if you're the first to go, you'll find 10 other coats on the same hook, but they'll be under yours, not over yours. Each person will take off the coat that's there and put his underneath, so that the one who comes to take his coat first, the one who put his coat there first, will not have to go searching between among the coats. It's something that Rebellia taught. When you go and you wash, and everybody lines up to wash for the meal, you will always find a cup full of water. You'll never have to pour your own cup of water. Never, ever. That's something Rebellia taught. You'll be woken up for the davening. Not in a cruel way, not in a harsh way, in a friendly way. Somebody who cares that you should be in the davening, that you shouldn't miss it. A responsibility one for the other. Little things like that are still left over today. But when he was there, it was much more than that. When he was there, you had a yeshiva full of tzaddikim. had a yeshiva of young men who were tzaddikim. Tzaddikim not just in what they did, but tzaddikim in how they felt, tzaddikim in how they reacted. And that was the beauty of being in a yeshiva where there was a Baal Musar. And the same applied in all the other yeshivas where there were Baalei Musar. But today there are no Baalei Musar left. He was one of the lost. One or two after him, one has died. There's virtually nobody left today who does that. And therefore the whole area of Musar is in very great and grave danger. There's an example of that in today's Sedra. The Medrash says, Medrash at the end of Kitovoy, Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, Besho she'omdu Yisrael al Har Sinai, when Yisrael stood on the mountain of Sinai, Va'omru, and they said, Kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh v'nishma, whatever the Ribbono Shel'Olam says, we will do, and we will listen, we will learn, we'll try and understand it. At that moment, the Jewish people reached the highest level they've ever reached. At that moment, they had undone the effects of Adam's sin. Everything was undone. Life could have been re-established as it was in Gan Eden at that moment. Through their own efforts, they had reached a level which was back to where Adam was before he sinned. It's unbelievable what level they were able to reach, bearing in mind that only 49 days before that, they were in the depths of despair. And even before that, we're told already that Roso Shifcho Alayam Mashaloi Ro Yecheskel Bin Buzi Bemaese Merkova, that even a Shifcho, a maidservant at the sea, was able to perceive more of the Ribbono Shel Olam than Yecheskel could when he saw the vision of the Maese Merkova, of the Ribbono Shel Olam's chariots, of the Ribbono Shel Olam's thrones. Yecheskel, one of the greatest prophets that ever was, and a maidservant before Matan Torah, could perceive, understood more Torah and understood more of spirituality and Kabbalah more than Yecheskel himself. Can you imagine what the men were like who learned? What the Rabbonim were like? What the Rosh Yeshiva were like? What the Gedolei Yisrael were like? What Moshe Rabbeinu was like? And that was weeks before the giving of the Torah. And at the giving of the Torah, when they stood together, all with one idea and united in one bond, at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they declared, Kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh v'nishma, we undertake, we'll do and we'll learn. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Mi gila labona razeh? Who taught them this? Where did they learn this from? What they've achieved in this statement is beyond anything they could know. Where did they know it from? The Ribbono Shel Olam himself expressed amazement at how far they had come. The fact that they were able to conceive of something which until that point was only known in heaven, it wasn't known in the world at all. And they knew it and they understood it. And at that point, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Mi yitein v'hoyo levavom ze Elohim. Ay, said the Ribbono Shel Olam, if only they would stay like this. Mi yitein. Who is there that could guarantee, that could see to it, that they would stay on this level? I'm skipping a bit of the Medrash, which I'll come back to just now. Medrash says further on, Kivan she'omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu mi yiten v'hoyo levavam zeh lohem, if only they would stay like this. Hoyo lohem loyma, they should have answered, Ribbono Shel Olam, atatein, you do it, you guarantee it. If you're so impressed with us and you would like us to stay like this, we would also like to stay like this, so why don't you do it for us, you help us. And the implication is clearly that had they done that, it would have been accepted. Ribbono Shel Olam would have kept the Bnei Yisrael on that level. But they didn't. They heard the Ribbono Shel Olam say it, and they let it pass. Why did they let it pass? Tosfos says, because they didn't want to be obligated to the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is a very deep concept. One of the whole ideas behind Adam's eating from the tree in the first place was because he wanted to achieve whatever he was going to achieve himself. He didn't want Na'ama de Kisufo, he didn't want bread of shame, he didn't want charity. And he'd been placed into the Garden of Eden on such a level that it wasn't so difficult to remain a wonderful person. Eating from the Eitz HaDa'as and remaining a wonderful person, now that's a challenge already. And the Eitz HaDa'as is what gave man the challenge of having to cope with a very potent Yetzer Hara. and having to make decisions and having to make choices which previously he didn't have. The decision of Adam HaRishon to become an Egan of Balabos, he wants to be independent. The same thing we see here. The Bnei Yisrael didn't want to feel that whatever level they've achieved is because God gave it to them. Okay, they achieved the peak for a moment, and the Rebbeinu Shalom said, "Miyitein," they said, "You do it and God did it." So from now on, every Jew would be born into this high level and would remain on this high level. Why? Because the Rebbeinu Shalom was guaranteeing it. He was underwriting it. That they didn't want. The whole challenge of living is to do it yourself. The whole challenge of living is to bear your own responsibility. To be able to achieve heights through one's own efforts. That's what they wanted. And they weren't prepared to take it from the Rebbeinu Shalom. This was the view that was shared by all of Bnei Yisrael at a time of their greatest height, when they perceived and understood Emeskait. They perceived and understood the truth like nobody has ever perceived it or understood it before or after. The height of their achievements spiritually and intellectually, at the moment of Na'aseh V'Nishma, they decide to forego God's volunteering to underwrite their retaining that level. They decide to do it themselves. We want to be independent. That's a feeling they had. And one would assume that since they were so great at that moment, that the feeling was a kosher feeling, was a good feeling. And by the sound of it, it is. By the sound of it, it makes a lot of sense. And Moshe calls them in the Avodah Zorah Daf Hei. Amale and Moshe Yisrael, kefuye toiva b'nei kefuye toiva. You ungrateful people, the sons of ungrateful people. He criticizes them. And what is the consequence of that feeling that they had? A few days later, the Egel Azov, the golden calf. Not only weren't they able to retain that level, but they dropped right down only a few days later. And that would never have happened had they taken the Ribbono Shel Olam up on his suggestion that they could remain on that level. Here we begin to see how confusing an emotion can be. How one can hear a feeling and consider it good and justified and positive, and it was the cause of the downfall of the people. It sounds a very good emotion. Please, Ribbono Shel Olam, we want to do it ourselves. Even if we're on a lower level, it must be our own. We must achieve it. If a parent would hear a child saying that, he would be happy. The parent says, "Come, little boy, I want to give you R500,000 and put you into business." And the son says, "Please, father, you know, it's wonderful that you want to give it to me, and I know it's always there. Let me try it on my own. I would like to try and make, I would like, even if I don't make R500,000, even if I only make 10,000, but I would like to feel I did it." Won't any father take pride in that? Won't any father feel that's a lovely idea? Okay, go try it on your own. What is wrong? Is there anything wrong with Bnei Yisrael turning around to the Ribbono Shel Olam and saying, "Ribbono Shel Olam, let us try it on our own. We want to try on our own." We see there is. What appears to be a wonderful feeling is in fact the cause of the downfall, and it's a feeling which is not allowed. It's wrong, it's incorrect, it's not a Torah Dikah feeling. And more disturbing than that, if a feeling so wrong, A, can appear so right, and B, if a feeling so wrong can be felt by people so high, what about us? That means that there's no connection between your spiritual level and the feelings that you have. That you can be on the highest level of spirituality and still have a feeling which is so wrong and so destructive and not know that there's anything wrong with it. That's crooked feeling. That's what it is. That no matter how high you are, how great you are, how perceptive and knowledgeable you are, that doesn't mean that your feelings are straight. You might even be a straight thinker, but it doesn't mean that your feelings are straight. What's crooked about that feeling? The Gemara is very difficult. The Gemara says they are kefuye toiva b'nei kefuye toiva. That's what Moshe said to them. You're ungrateful sons of the ungrateful. What does he mean? Kefuye toiva. You yourselves are ungrateful. Dichtiv, as it is said, v'nafshenu kotzo b'lechem hakeloikel. Because only a little while ago you referred to the mon as lechem hakeloikel, which means this light food. The food, the mon, had no waste to it. It was all 100% nutritious. The result of that was that the people never had to use a toilet, which was a special chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Since there was holiness in the area where the camp was, where the people were encamped, the din was that any toilets would have to be constructed outside of the camp. The camp was about 3 miles long. The camp of Israel, and therefore it would be necessary for anybody who's living on the inner rim of the Machane Israel would have to walk 3 miles every time he wanted to go to the toilet. It was absurd. So as a chesed, as a kindness, the Ribbono Shelam gives the mon which has no waste to it whatever, and they refer to it as lechem akalokim. They get tired of it. They were just like ordinary food, like everybody else eats. It's light, they don't feel that it's substantial enough, they don't feel that it's heavy enough, it doesn't feel like you're really eating. They would like food like they used to get in Egypt. That's kfuye teva. The very thing which the Ribbono Shel'olam has given you as the gift, that's what you complain about. Kfuye teva is not just that you don't appreciate. Kfuye teva is that on the very point that he's giving you, that's the very point you pick on as being the point that's no good. And it's amazing how often we do that. That when we want to make fun of something or we want to take something lightly, we hit in its strongest point, in the greatest point, and that's where we pull it down. They call it the light food. And that's the kefuye tova. Not right. What's the b'nai kefuye tova? Why are they sons of people who don't appreciate? Dichtiv, as it says, Ha'isho asher nosato imodi. The woman that you gave me, she gave me to eat from the tree, and that's why I ate. Going back to Adam, this ties up with the last year that we had several weeks ago, connecting the eagle, you remember, with the Eitz Hadas. It was the Erev Rav who caused the eagle. The Erev Rav was the Eitz Hadas, the connection that we discussed in those last two shiurim. Here again we see the same concept. Kfuye teva b'nei kfuye teva. Where did this start, this tendency not to appreciate something, this tendency to pick on the greatness and mock the greatness? It started with Adam HaRishon already. And one has to understand, what does it mean that it started with Adam? Adam, who was the greatest man that's ever been created, greatest in intellect, greatest in midas, greatest in every way, a man who was actually created by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, by his own hands. What does it mean that Adam didn't appreciate Chas V'Shalom? The Alter von Slabodka explains that particular posuk as the fact that when the Ribbono Shel Olam created the woman, he created her not because Adam needed somebody to cook for him. The Gemara says they had plenty of angels who did all the cooking and cleaning that needed to be done. That was not part of life in Gan Eden. It wasn't necessary to cook and to clean and to do all those things. That was a result of the curse afterwards. The creation of the Isha was, as the Gemara says in Nida, that she was given an aspect of intuition and knowledge which a man doesn't have, a bino yaseira. She had a perception which a man lacked. In other words, the Ribbono Shel Olam felt that Adam needed an isha for avodas Hashem, for his spiritual development, not for his physical development. Man was capable of reproducing himself without women. Man was capable of surviving very nicely and managing very well without women. Angels did whatever he needed. So why did God make a woman when God says, Nisa Ezek in the Ezek Kenegdo, let us give him a help. A help in what area? In the spiritual area. That's her main function. That's where a man needs a woman. He can employ a housekeeper to do all the rest. Where he needs a wife is in the area of spiritual development, not in the area of physical development. So when Adam turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, you gave me a wife for my spiritual development because she has a bina yaseira, she has an understanding that I don't have. Surely I'm entitled to rely on her in certain areas? You wouldn't have given me somebody to add intellect, to add knowledge and to add awareness, and now you're going to hammer me because I listened to her. Then I was better off without her. So Adam's taina is a good taina. It's a good answer. But Chazal notes, just in the words of Nosato, Asher Nosato Yimodi, you didn't have to say, Adam, the woman you gave. You could just have said, the woman did it. That's all. The Ribbono Shel Olam will understand what you mean exactly. It's not necessary for you to use that word. The choice of word indicates a deep, deep subconscious touch of a lack of appreciation of the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam, after all, gave it to you for your good, not for his. He didn't need the wife. You needed the wife. That word shouldn't have been chosen. So in both these instances, they're very deep and subtle expressions of a lack of gratitude. It's not Chas V'Shalom that the Bnei Israel didn't appreciate the mon and that Adam didn't appreciate his wife. They did. But there was just a touch of something not right. Now on the surface, those two examples are completely different to the example with which we're dealing, where the Bnei Israel turned down God's offer to keep them on the level that they've achieved. They say we don't want it because we don't want to remain obligated to you for that. We want to do it ourselves. That means they appreciate that if God does something for you, you're going to be obligated. So how can they be called Kefuye Tova? On the contrary, these are people who understand the obligations created by being helped. And that's why they don't want to be helped. Whereas the examples of Adam and the Bnei Israel with Ammon are examples of people who, having been helped, didn't note fully the extent to which they were helped. And on the surface, these seem to be completely different concepts. On the contrary, this seems to be a very great level that is achieved of Bnei Israel in saying they don't want the help in this area because they know if they get it, they will have to be completely obligated to the Bnei Israel forever. That means they appreciate the levels of Akoras HaTov, of gratitude that would have to be expressed if they took God up on his offer. And yet it's not so. And that's the chiddush of this piece of Gemara. The Medrash gives a moshel, gives an example. Lema adov adome, what can this be compared to? Lechover echot kosher, a very outstanding snake charmer. Shero achno achas kosher, saw a very tough snake. Omar, he looked at the snake and he said, Mi yuchal lechover ezu, who can charm the snake, who can tame the snake? Now what are people meant to answer in such a case? Imagine that we have a cobra sitting on the table here listening to the shir, going wild, and somebody walks in and says, right, who can charm the snake? What are we meant to answer? Obviously you, let's see. Amru loy v'loy at, hachaver akol mimach. After all, you the master in this kind of thing, you surely are the one who does it. Kach kivan shema, and then the Midrash goes on with what we read. So when the Ribbono Shel Olam said, who could guarantee that they remain on this level? It's the most pathetic Midrash. Just see what happens. The snake charmer comes in, and there's this wild snake, and everybody's terrified of him. And he says, who can tame the snake? And everybody shrugs their shoulders and carry on. Why doesn't he come in and say, I can tame the snake? He wants you to pause a moment to realize that you can't. That's what he wants. He wants you to, otherwise you won't appreciate the greatness of what he's doing. If everybody thinks it's so easy, then he's not ready to do his trick yet. He's got to give you a chance to try, or at least to realize that it's beyond you, that you can't do it. Just a moment he needs to do it. That's good education. Don't give an answer too quickly. Let the student grapple with the question until he realizes that he can't answer it, and then you answer it. Then he'll understand the chokhmah. If you answer it before he's had that opportunity, he doesn't understand the chokhmah. If a person comes to a Gemara Shir unprepared, at best he understands the Gemara, but to understand the Shir, he doesn't understand one thing about the Shir. It's not possible. He hasn't grappled with the problems yet, so he hasn't noticed that there are solutions. He thinks it's all easy. He thinks that's what the Gemara says. It's only when he's tried himself and has gone as far as he can, and he's got stuck, and then he comes to a Shir and various things are raised and solved and answered, then he understands the Shir. So it is with the snake charmer, and so loved it with the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. The Ribbono Shel Olam comes and says, who can guarantee that you can remain on this level? And he wanted them to say, we can't, Ribbono Shel Olam. We can't guarantee it. Only you can. Please. Over to you. And they just carry on. Why do they do that? They don't realize that feeling obligated in itself is a very great value. And that's the chiddush of this Gemara. That it's not, when they decide that they don't want to feel obligated, why not? Because they think feeling obligated is negative. There's a pasuk in Mishlei, a man who hates gifts is alive, that's a real living man. A person who loves things for nothing is not a real living man. Part of life, to be really living, you need to not want anything for nothing. So here too, again, isn't this a wonderful feeling? We don't want anything for nothing, we want to do it all ourselves. No, that's wrong. There's great advantage in feeling obligated. The feeling of being obligated is a kosher feeling. That's a feeling one needs to have. And we're taught the opposite. And we think we're so clever when we try and be independent. Break away from your parents. Do it yourself. Be independent. It's not like that. It's exactly the opposite. We're educated in schools to become independent. We're educated in our learning to become independent. We think the greatest level is to become independent. No. The greatest level is to become a Talmid Chochem. Not to become a Chochem. When you become a Chochem, nobody's going to learn from you. Become a Talmid Chochem. Greatest level is to learn by a Chochem, to be a Talmid of a Chochem, not to be a Chochem. Not to become independent. The greatest level is to feel attached and to feel obligated. One to another, husband to a wife, parent to a child, child to a parent, friends to one another. That's what the greatest level is, to feel that obligation. What does the Pasuk mean, Soinei Matonis Yichye, that the person who hates gifts will live? A person who is obligated and hates gifts, he will live. That's how it's meant to be. The conflict created by one's wanting not to have gifts and taking gifts, that's the conflict which creates life. That's what life is made from. The desire to pay for everything you've received, but not to receive because you don't want to pay. The person says, I don't want anything for nothing, and I don't want to pay for anything. So you'll starve, you'll die. That's not life. Life is you go to the shop and you want, so you take. But that's stealing, so you pay. Where do you get money from to pay? You've got to work. So you work for your balabos. Your balabos wants you to work. He takes from you. But taking from you and not paying you, that's stealing, so he pays you. That's how an economy works. That's how a society works. That's how people work. Not by saying, I'm not going to work for anybody, I'm not going to employ anybody, I'm not going to buy anything, I'm not going to sell anything. Then life comes to a complete standstill. Life is obligating yourself. Putting yourself under somebody. Putting yourself in a position of obligation and wanting like anything to pay it off. And being unable to pay it off. And the more you pay, the more the other side feels now they have to pay. And that we've talked about often, how the Akoros HaTov sets off a chain motion, a chain reaction which is never ending. That's what Bnei Yisrael didn't understand. The Ribbono Shel is offering you an opportunity to become enslaved to him. He's offering you an opportunity where not only everything you've got physically, but even everything you've got spiritually is from him. All you did was you got to the level of Na'aseh v'Nishma, which is also a great achievement. But your ability to stay at the level of Na'aseh v'Nishma, God did. And that will make you so obligated to God that you'll never be able to repay him. And provided you don't like that feeling, provided you would like to repay him, you'll try and repay him all your life. And then we'll have a society as a society should be. You'll never do an Aveira. You'll do mitzvahs and mitzvahs and mitzvahs. You'll do chesed and you'll do tzedakah. You'll learn Torah. You'll raise your children to Torah. There'll be nothing more important in your life than trying to show God to pay back. Because everything you've got is from him. That's the position God wanted them to be in. But he couldn't do that without giving them the opportunity to see that it involved HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If he would just have come and frozen them on that level and kept them there, they wouldn't have realized that they were under obligation. He had to come like the magician and say, right, who can do this? Who can pull a rabbit out of the hat? And everybody's supposed to look and shake the shoulder and say, you surely. That's what he wanted, so that they would realize they couldn't do it. Right, I am the one who can do it, I'll do it. And then he keeps them at that level. And they become obliged and obligated to him for the rest of eternity. But they don't. And that's why Moshe says, I trace that tendency in your characters all the way back to Adam HaRishon. That's not something from today. You call them Mon Lechem Aklokel, that's the same Midah. And Adam HaRishon, when he turned to God and he said, the wife you gave me, that's the same middah, it's the same characteristic. You're not prepared to feel obligated. You'll do anything to get out of the obligation. So the mon, all you have to do is give it that name, the light food. And that subconsciously already eases your sense of obligation. The light stuff, the stuff that doesn't really satisfy that we've been getting here in the desert. That's all you need to do. The fact that you've been getting it for nothing, you forget about. The fact that you get it miraculously, you forget about. The fact that you don't have to cook it and you don't have to wash our plates and everything's done for you, that you forget about. What sticks in people's mind is the nickname. If the nickname is accurate, that's what sticks in people's mind. Somebody once said to me, if you want to destroy a person, just give him a nickname. But see that the nickname's accurate. And you'll destroy him for life. Because society recognizes an accurate nickname. It's got to be just accurate that it pinpoints his strength and you turn it into a weakness. And then you've got him pinned for life. Very cruel, but that's what we do. The lechem akloikel. The woman you gave me. I didn't want her, you gave it to me. Why did you give it to me? Because she had some greatness. She could understand things that I couldn't understand. Her, fat lot, she understands. Look what she's done now. So don't tell me I'm obligated to you for finding me a wife. I'm obligated to you for finding me a wife who got me into this trouble. So there goes my obligation. It's deep down, it's not on the surface, but there's a touch of it in Adam Harishon's choice of words. Just the choice of words shows that deep down in his subconscious there's a desire to remove his obligation to God for having received the wife by blaming her for the eating of the fruit. And that lack of feeling of obligation is created, is a necessity, it's automatic. God has to start the world somewhere, which means he has to start by making a man. That man is now 100% obligated to God. We have the opportunity, we who came there afterwards, of forgetting about God. It's feasible. We have the free choice not to believe in God. And they teach us evolution and all the rest. We can answer all the questions. It can all be answered scientifically. No God. We've got that choice. But Adam, what could he say? No God, so who made me? I started it all off. So he has this feeling of obligation more than anybody else. He has the Nama de Ksufo. He, after all, is being handed it all on a golden plate, particularly being put into Gan Eden. So his obligation to the Ribbono Shel Olam is absolutely total. There must be some drive, if the Ribbono Shel Olam has implanted in us a desire not to receive gifts, which we need to have that desire. That's the origin of the Yetzirah. First, man is created totally obligated to God, with a desire to be obligated to nobody. That creates the pressure to do things, to say things, to think things, which will reduce the obligation. And that's what the Yetzirah is in its original form. That led him to eat from the tree. And that was the introduction of the Erev Rav. And it was the Erev Rav and that involvement in humanity that was responsible for the Jewish people, even while they were saying Naaseh v'Nishma, even while they were on this high level, to have one aspect of wrong feeling, but so wrong and so harmful. What was that little touch? We're going to try and stay here ourselves. Don't you interfere, God. We want to do it ourselves. I had a person, in fact, in my study only this week, who was telling me what a great person he is. He has never taken anything from his parents since he's married. His parents are very wealthy. He hasn't taken a penny. They've offered to help, gifts, nothing, absolutely nothing. Isn't that fantastic? And I said to him, and how will you feel when you're a parent and your child takes nothing from you? Turns down everything you want to give the child says, no thank you, manage on my own. What are you going to feel like? He stopped for a moment. Another example of a man who thought he was a tzaddik. I've taken nothing, and all he's doing is hurting his parents, hurting him. Parents who want to give, and they've got what to give, canine horror, and he's an only child. The hurt that he's causing them by not taking chas v'shalom, and he hasn't realized it, a wrong feeling. I want to do it myself, I want to be independent. I don't want to be, what he's really saying is, I don't want to be over obligated to my parents. That's what he's really saying. It's a wrong feeling, not wrong thinking. The thinking is straight. If you'll explain it rationally, you'll have to say the thinking is straight. The feeling is wrong. That's not midas. That's not how we think. That's not how we feel. It's an incorrect emotion. It's a crooked emotion. You've got to feel obligated to your parents. That's the whole point. And then try and pay them. You don't want anything for nothing. Don't refuse to take. Take and repay. That's what it should all be. Give them nachas. That's what they want. So take the money, take the material things and give them nachas. No, he would rather not take the material, not give them nachas. What kind of situation is that? Another person also this week. Can't understand why his marriage is cracking up. He gives his wife whatever she needs, whatever she wants, everything. He loves her beyond imagining. And it's true, I know it. He does. And what he won't do for her, it's almost absurd what he won't give this girl. And she's bored, she wants out. And I say to her, but why do you want out? I don't know, she says. It's crazy. I don't know. There must be something wrong with me because I've got nothing to complain about. Whatever I want, I get. So she comes to me saying, is my feeling wrong? Am I feeling incorrect? The answer is no, you're feeling correct. Your feeling is correct. He's wrong. And I call him in and he says, well, I don't know what you're talking about. A problem in my marriage? I don't know what you're talking about. I love my wife. She gives me whatever I need. I give her whatever she needs. There's no problem in my marriage.
You're giving her everything you need, but that what you're giving her is of no value because she's never seen you withhold. She doesn't know you're capable of withholding. She's never seen you say no. She's never seen you demand anything. You think that by not demanding and by not creating pressure and by not creating obligation, you think she's happy? People are happy when they feel obligated and they're able to meet their obligations, not when they don't feel obligated. Imagine you start a business and you go to the bank manager and you say, no, starting the business, this is what I plan to do, this is my budget, I need R1 million, I need a loan. The bank manager says, sure, there's R1 million, when must I pay it back? Forget about paying. No, don't have to worry. So, you know, R1 million goes in a week. If that's the basis, you're back there a week later. How's business going? Very well, but I need R1 million. Sure, here's R1 million, take R1 million. One doesn't enjoy doing business like that. What you enjoy doing business is right, you've got R1 million. But I want to see your balance sheets in 6 months' time, and it's got to be in such and such a form, and this is how it's got to appear, and I want R1 million paid back within 2 years. And you come back in 2 years' time, and you give him a check, then you feel good. You've had obligations, and you've met the obligations. That's when life is real. That's when people are operating together. That's when people... But when people avoid obligations, and they think they're tzaddiki, that's not a tzaddik. That's a person who's turning down life. That's a person who's stopping life in its tracks. And we see that in the parasha itself. Vayashkimu mimocharos, they make this golden calf. What's the golden calf? We don't have time to go in, and I've given a shiur before on what it is. Also, it's a deep concept. These great people didn't dance around the golden calf and think that this is what brought them out of Egypt. But just one little glimpse at one idea. The golden calf is a god they made, not a god that made them, that's all. So we don't owe it anything. It owes us. That's what they wanted. Leadership which owes its position to them, not leadership to which they owe their position. We want to elect our leaders. It was the same argument later on with Korach. We want to elect our god. We want to make him. We want to create our own laws, enact our own laws. We don't want it imposed upon us. If it's imposed upon us, we're obligated. If we make God, God is obligated to us. We're not obligated to Him. Vayashkimu mimocharos, and they got up early the next morning. They're so excited with their new concept. They've invented democracy. Vayalu oilos, the first thing is they bring sacrifices. And an oilo is the highest level of sacrifice, a sacrifice which is burnt completely to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And they weren't bringing the sacrifice to the golden calf. They were bringing it to God, to the Ribbono Shel Olam Himself. There was no change there. The only change was in the direction of responsibility. Instead of us being responsible to you, God, we've got Moshe out of the way who was teaching us that old-fashioned nonsense that we owe you a living, that we're obliged to you. Now this is modern religion, Ribbono Shel Olam. You're still our God and all the rest of it. But we are declaring you our God. We're choosing you. You're our chosen God. We're not your chosen people. Isn't that a much higher level God? It's not because you held the mountain over us. It's because we've voted for you. But we won't tell God, but the catch is, you now work for us, not we work for you. And after that, Vayagishu Shlomim. Then comes Shlomim. Shlomim is another level of sacrifice. Also, it's sacrifice for the Ribbono Shel Olam, but that the Baalim eat. The owners of the sacrifice already eat. Down a level. Vayeshev Ha'om Lechol. And they sat down to eat. Not Lishtos. The Pasuk doesn't say they sat down to drink. Chas V'Sholem, this is serious business. No drinking. They didn't sit down to drink, but the shosoi they drank. They're falling down lower. They started off with oilos. They went down to shlomim. Then they sat down to eat. Now they're already drinking. Vayokumu, and then they got up. Letzachek, to laugh. And Rashi says in that laughter there were touches already of immorality, of messing around. It was lightheaded laughing. It wasn't serious laughing. There's serious simcha, and there's light simcha. I always say there are three kinds of Yiddishkeit. There's the Yiddishkeit where people take the Torah seriously and they take themselves seriously. And that's an oppressive, destructive Yiddishkeit. You see people walking around with their shoulders bent and a long expression over their face. They take themselves seriously and they take the Torah seriously. That's no good. And then you have a Yiddishkeit where they don't take themselves seriously and they don't take the Torah seriously. That's also no good. That's like Yakumu Letzachek. It's all laughter and it's all a big joke and there's no obligation and there's no responsibility. And then you've got in the end the Mususku. Take Torah seriously. Don't take yourself too seriously. You've got a long way to go. You're not terribly important. But Torah, that yes, that's serious. And the Vayakumu Letzachek removes the seriousness of Torah. That's removed. Why? No obligations. The obligations of God. Of course that's lightheadedness. That's what lightheadedness is. Tzchoik and kalus roish, lightheadedness and laughter is exactly that. When a person feels the oil is gone, the yoke is gone, he's not working for anybody, he's free. That feeling of freedom is exactly what they desired. And it has its origins back with Adam Arisha, back with the Eitz Hadas. We see here the existence and the danger of a crooked feeling, that one can be on the greatest level of learning, of knowledge, of spiritual attainment. One can be standing at an Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, a big Talmid Chacham, with all one's thoughts 100% pure and straight, but with feelings that are wrong. Plain simply, with feelings that are wrong. And those feelings can be so wrong that they can cause one to drop to the very depths of despair and degradation. From Naitev and Ishma, in a short period of time, they're dancing around the golden calf because of a wrong feeling. And that wrong feeling has been passed down from generation to generation from Adam HaRishon. It was so slight and subtle in Adam HaRishon. If Chazal didn't tell us about it, we would never know about it. And we would never suspect it. It's only because it's pointed out by Chazal that deep down there was just a little touch of it. And that little touch is still there many centuries later with the Bnei Yisrael in the desert, where they refer to the Mon as Lechem HaKelokim. And finally it causes their downfall when the God offers to help them out and they turn him down to remain independent. It's that same feeling. They don't realize that the remaining not independent, remaining dependent is what life is all about. Provided you don't enjoy being dependent. To be dependent and to strive for independence, that's what life is all about. But never to achieve independence, never to be independent. That's what it's all about. Creating obligations and meeting those obligations. Not running away from the obligations. That's a feeling, but you get an idea of how much analysis, how much depth, how much care has to go into analyzing a feeling. And when the Baalei Musa talk about self-analysis, that's what they're talking about. Analyzing one's feelings. Are they kosher? You feel something, it can feel very holy. But is that what it really is? Is it really Kedusha? Are you really feeling holiness? Or are you feeling something else? We did speak a few weeks ago about a situation where you can be sitting around a Yom Tov table and you feel tremendous Kedusha and you're singing and you're having a glass of wine and enjoying good food and you're feeling Kedusha. And the Baalei Musa would say to you afterwards, just analyze carefully, was it really Kedusha you were feeling or were you enjoying a pleasant evening around a good table with good company, good food and wine? Is that what it was or was it really Kedusha? Or perhaps a mixture of both? But don't be so sure that it's the highest levels of Kedusha that you've been standing on. Not so simple. One needs to refine oneself and refine and examine and examine to really be sure that the feelings are kosher and are straight. That doesn't mean that one goes into a state of permanent self-analysis and psychoanalysis and self-consciousness and depression. But it does mean that one has to be conscious of that. That feelings need to be monitored. Feelings need to be directed. Feelings can't just be followed. Before a feeling is going to be followed, it needs to be checked out carefully. Is the feeling correct? Does it match with halacha? Does it match with Torah? Is it as one is meant to feel? Or do I need to adjust those feelings? And we're fully capable of adjusting a feeling. A feeling can be altered, it can be changed, it can be developed. There are ways to do it. As long as we know that it needs to be done. And with that, in Yetzer Hashem, we should find that we have the correct guidance to know that there is such a thing, and to put our fingers on it when it needs to be put onto it, and to rectify it when it needs to be rectified. So much tzoras in families could be avoided if you could just get the people together and say, look, I know how you feel, but is it correct to feel that way? I know how you feel, is it correct to feel that way? And just to understand that those feelings need to be readjusted. So many problems could be solved between people, between all sorts of situations, if one could just treat each feeling on that basis. And it can be done and it must be done.